The headline: Southeast Asian foreign ministers warn against any provocative action in the region, saying there's a risk of the situation spiraling into open conflicts. Iran says U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits of the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. And Syria says Israel's nuclear activities pose a major threat to regional and international security, calling for comprehensive inspections of the regime's nuclear facilities. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: ministers from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations have warned of an open conflict amid simmering tensions between Beijing and Washington over the U.S. House Speaker's visit to Taiwan. In a joint statement, the minister said the situation could lead to miscalculation, serious confrontation, open conflicts, and unpredictable consequences among major powers. The spokesman for the association also urged both sides to stabilize the situation. The remarks come as a furious Beijing is planning its biggest ever exercises around Taiwan in response to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to the self-ruled island. The trip by Pelosi has sent tensions soaring between the world's two largest economies, with Beijing regarding it as a major provocation. China's launched its largest ever military exercises around Taiwan after a visit to the self-ruled island by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The maneuvers feature live fire, sea, and air drills in multiple areas around Taiwan. The drills are taking place at some points as close as 20 kilometers from the island. The exercises kicked off on Tuesday and are slated to conclude next Sunday. The drills have drawn a strong reaction from Taiwan, which said its military was closely monitoring China's maneuvers. Taiwan said it will, quote, uphold the principle of preparing for war without seeking war. Taiwan added it was trying not to escalate the situation and cause any disputes. Iran's UN ambassador says U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits of the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Majid Tahrir Avanchi made the remarks in an address to the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said U.S. withdrawal from the deal in May 2018 and reimposition of unilateral sanctions prevented Iran's enjoyment of the deal's economic benefits. Iran's envoy said the country has been negotiating in goodwill with other parties to the deal to resume full implementation of the accord. Tahrir Avanchi said Iran will return to full implementation of the deal when the U.S. makes the right decision. Since the U.S.'s withdrawal, the remaining parties have held several rounds of talks to revive the deal. The talks failed to make breakthroughs due to the U.S.'s failure to show goodwill and its successive demands. A new round of talks is due to start in the Austrian capital. Iran's top negotiator, Ali Barghari-Khani, has called on the U.S. to seize the latest opportunity. Well, Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy. Salman Kudri reports.
Defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states, because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria says Israel's nuclear facilities pose a major threat to regional and international security and must be subjected to comprehensive inspections by the UN Nuclear Agency. Bassam Sabah made the remarks while addressing the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said Israel continues to refuse to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty due to unbridled support of the United States and its Western allies. Sabah added that Syria offered a resolution on making West Asia a nuclear-free zone in 2003, but it was blocked by the U.S. Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The occupying entity has so far refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the non-proliferation treaty. Head of Iraq's Fatah Alliance, Hadi al-Amri, says he supports Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's demand for holding early elections. Amri says the issue requires a national dialogue in the provision of suitable conditions for holding free and transparent voting. On Wednesday, Sadr called for dissolution of parliament and said he has no interest in negotiating with his rivals. He said most Iraqis are angry with the ruling class in its entirety. Since Saturday, Sadr's supporters have occupied the parliament in protest at nomination of Mohammad Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. Sadr's bloc emerged as the biggest faction from the latest elections last October, but it was still far short of a majority. He ordered his bloc's 73 lawmakers to quit the parliament in June after failing to nominate a prime minister. The U.S. has announced the killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Afghanistan, but the timing of his killing is somewhat questionable. After al-Zawahiri had been on the run for 20 years following the 9/11 attacks in the United States, now Washington announces his killing months after it withdrew forces from the country it had occupied. One must also not forget that the U.S. was behind the creation of al-Qaeda.
The United States says it has killed the al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amadi, who was an employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Zawahiri's death. Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of US troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal.
Well, there have been numerous reports about the U.S.'s ties with former al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Some sources have said that the CIA had ties with him and the so-called Afghan Arab fighters. This is when the U.S. armed Mujahideen grouped to fight during the Soviet-Afghan war.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The U.S.-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish U.S. politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth as the Taliban of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like al-Qaeda and ISIL.
Experts in nuclear weapons and technology gather for a forum in Seoul to discuss the potential crisis if Pyongyang conducts a seventh nuclear test and related issues this week. The Sejong Conference on Non-Proliferation comes as the U.S. and South Korea are set to engage in the largest joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula in 4 years. Our Seoul-based correspondent in the South Korean capital has a report for us.
Temporary freeze by...
Leading analysts gathered in Seoul, South Korea, and remotely from the United States to discuss North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the potential crisis should Pyongyang conduct a seventh nuclear test. Some admitted past strategies had failed and argued that North Korea's security concerns needed more attention and consideration.
We need to somehow address DPRK's strong motives for going nuclear. But what we did against DPRK was only strengthening DPRK's incentives to go nuclear.
North Korea suspended its nuclear and long-range missile testing following a 2018 summit between leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Now, years later, the U.S.-led sanctions Pyongyang had hoped to see removed remain in place. The discussion of North Korea's nuclear program comes as new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol implements a more hardline approach to Pyongyang. President Yoon has called for the South's military to develop preemptive strike capabilities against the North as part of a so-called kill chain military strategy. President Yoon has also moved to restart suspended large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S., a move that Pyongyang has previously viewed as a provocation of war. The drills are scheduled to take place later this month. Meanwhile, many analysts believe such an approach will lead to greater tension.
The only way to address the risks of accident, misperception, or miscalculation is to try to manage deterrence through risk reduction. Limitations on military exercises, cessation of missile testing, force exclusion zones around the DMZ, sort of a mix of steps that both North Korea and South Korea and the United States would take in the conventional and strategic areas.
Experts also suggest a failure to reduce risks may encourage both South Korea and Japan to develop nuclear weapons themselves. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
In the limelight. The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see, says Hamid Debashi, author, in an article published under the heading, Western Universities Struggle to Grow Away from Their Racist Roots. Stay tuned for more. Last April, Harvard President Larry Baitow released the report of the Committee on Harvard and Legacy of Slavery, accepted the committee's recommendations in full, and announced a historic commitment of $100 million to fund their implementation, according to a detailed internal report on the school's four-century connection to slavery. This seems to be a season of public penance for American universities as they come to terms with nasty skeletons in their closets. How can a university muster the moral authority to teach anyone anything with that kind of horrid past? The report by a committee of Harvard faculty members is Harvard's effort to begin redressing the wrongs of the past, as some other universities have been doing for decades, according to an article in the New York Times. But how exactly is this redressing to be done? When people heard John Henry Newman's lofty ideas in 1850s, later collected in the volume The Idea of a University, they might be forgiven for thinking that Europeans and Americans were truly engaged in the perfection of the human soul, and that universities were a place to cultivate young people for an upright moral life. Really? Enslaved men and women served Harvard presidents and professors in fed and cared for Harvard students, the Harvard Report reveals. Was that evidence of Newman's ideas reaching the New World? The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see. This is not a cause for jubilation or even for a sigh of relief that truth is finally triumphing. This is a moment for reflection and an opportunity for remedy. The structural issues such as reports that expose for the next generations of higher education. At least since the reflections of the towering Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, we have known that education is a solid source of cultural hegemony of the ruling class. But the relatively widespread availability of higher education and the attraction of a global body of students to US and European universities has demographically altered their compositions. A much larger and more diverse body of students, faculty, and administration is now attentive to the roots and fruits of these universities. This cycle of soul-searching began some two decades ago with Brown University examining its roots in slavery. Soon afterwards, Harvard College acknowledged it had relied on slave labor, and Princeton University admitted to holding a slave auction in 1766. At University of Columbia, sons of merchants involved in the slave trade were enrolled, while Dartmouth College admitted that at one time there had been arguably as many enslaved black people as there were students. That was at a time when University of Pennsylvania faculty and alumni were actively involved in framing the Constitution to support slavery. European universities were not exempt. Oxford began probing its own role in British colonialism in 2019, in what The Guardian described as a pioneering effort to crowdsource and decolonize its own imperialist part. This led to the establishment of an informed and informative website detailing the history of Oxford's racist roots in slavery and colonialism. These events at Oxford started with a student-led movement that originated in South Africa called Rhodes Must Fall, a reference to Cecil Rhodes, Oxford's imperialist benefactor. But Oxford ultimately decided to keep its Rhodes statue intact because it would have been too expensive to remove it. Other UK universities are equally implicated. The University of Glasgow admitted it had received more than $258 million from people who derived their wealth from slavery, while the University of Bristol estimated that 85% of the wealth used to found the university depended on slave labor, according to Reuters. On both sides of the Atlantic, U.S. and European universities were founded on the profits made from transatlantic slave trade and the lucrative business of colonialism. In these universities, the children of slave traders and colonial officers were educated, and indeed indoctrinated, in the validity of their conquest and in the political culture and moral depravity that sustained this sick tradition. What do we do now? Admitting mea culpa is, of course, necessary but not sufficient. Revelations that top American and universities in the Europe were heavily invested in slavery, benefited from the slave trade, and were institutional advocates of colonialism is a major event in the history of higher education. But what exactly needs to be done once such revelations are widely publicized? Allocation of resources to diversify the student and faculty body to include the descendants of the impoverished, robbed, and denigrated communities, Black people, Native Americans, Latins, and students and faculty from across the colonial world is, of course, an absolute must. While Western universities are today quite cognizant of the disenfranchised communities in their midst and seek to recruit more from these communities, this does not apply to students from around the world subject to their colonial and imperial violence. This is a serious shortcoming. Students and scholars from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the EU and US have been definitive to their national miseries, must be given particular attention. Today, Afghan and Iraqi students in particular need to be given financial resources for their higher education in American and European universities. But what exactly are these students and scholars to study or teach in these universities? Further indoctrination in white supremacist curricula. The urgent task of remedying the horrors of the past must include serious reconsideration of the future of college curricula. Meaningful reparations can only occur when the history of racism, slavery, and colonialism is brought to the forefront inside European and American university classrooms. But today, even the body of scholarship produced under the rubric of critical race theory or intersectionality is under attack by reactionary forces in Europe and the US. Private universities, at the mercy of political pressure, could never lead the way, except within the conservative context determined by their wealthy donors, which continue to oppose any serious curricular changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, crucial public sphere where such changes can be inaugurated. Consider when the New York Times launched two crucial projects, the 1619 Project on the History of Slavery and the Haiti Ransom Project on French colonialism in Haiti. To be sure, these two seminal projects are based on generations of scholarship, but such a scholarship does not easily translate into curricular changes. Western civilization continues to be the code word for the sustained indoctrination of successive generations of students who are kept critically unaware, not just of other civilizations, but also of the troubling origins of civilizational thinking. Nothing enduring or significant follows so long as we have curricular apartheid in the world. With Western civilization receiving preferential treatment and enormous resources, while other civilizations, cultures, and accompanying suffering are delegated to the poorly financed periphery. Today, issues of environmental justice, mass refugees, labor migration, and the organically changing character of world cultures are far more crucial to understand than a fake and forced emphasis on Western civilization. Today, the most racist white supremacist political movements are sustained and agitated by false assumptions about the uniqueness and superiority of Western civilization, to which elite universities remain committed. There is no redressing the sustained history of U.S. and European universities' involvement with slavery, racism, and colonialism without first dismantling its sustained ideological premise.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has touched down in Chinese Taipei. As expected, China is fuming. Chinese warplanes are circling Chinese Taipei in what has been described as targeted military operations. But what are the targets? Chinese Taipei or U.S. military bases? Or is the target a country in that region that many would not even think of, namely Japan? Those questions and what motives the U.S. House Speaker had behind her visit are just a few of the questions that we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight.
Over the past few decades, China and the United States have been on the collision course on various issues, ranging from trade, human rights, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, to the COVID-19 outbreak. The already tense relation has soured further with a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, a self-ruled island Beijing considers as part of its territory. Pelosi made a one-day trip to Taiwan during her ongoing East Asia tour, despite repeated warnings from Beijing that such a move could embolden pro-independence forces there. She used an Air Force plane to get to Taiwan, while over a dozen American fighter jets kept an eye on her. Upon arrival, Pelosi defended the controversial visit.
Our delegation's visit to Taiwan honors America's unwavering commitment to supporting Taiwan's vibrant democracy.
During her trip, Pelosi met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. She was also awarded the highest civilian award as a, quote, symbol of America's strong and enduring friendship with the island. In response to the visit, Beijing has announced military drills, including a series of live fire maneuvers around Taiwan, including in the strategic Taiwan Strait. Taipei has reacted angrily, saying the drills and encircling of the island by Chinese forces are similar to an invasion. Beijing has also put curbs on some imports from Taiwan, while halting sand shipments to the island.
This is a complete farce. The United States is violating China's sovereignty under the guise of so-called democracy. Those who offend China will be punished. Those who play with fire will not come to a good end.
Pelosi has already concluded her trip to Taiwan, but it seems to have negative and far-reaching consequences for the island and the U.S., as Beijing has described Washington's action as extremely dangerous. Taiwan is not the only irritant issue in ties between Beijing and Washington. The U.S. is missing no chance to pit regional countries against China, whether there is a maritime dispute or other bilateral issues. The reality is that there are several economic, political, and strategic issues involved in U.S. policies in Asia-Pacific. One can also not ignore the constant U.S. meddling under the pretext of security amid rising China's influence. It's too early to say that China and the U.S. may engage in an open conflict. But with ever-increasing frictions and the continued U.S. meddling, it seems that the strained ties between the two are very unlikely to ease anytime soon.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Oh A Soon, Principal Advisor, the Pacific Research Center of Malaysia, joins us from Sabah. We also have Scott Ritter, a former UN weapons inspector, who joins us from Bethlehem in New York. Welcome to you both. Scott Ritter, I'm going to start with you first, and it's a very basic question. Nancy Pelosi has visited Chinese Taipei. What now?
What now is, I think there's a Chinese saying that he who ties the bell on the tiger's tail has to take it off. Nancy's tied a bell on the tail of a tiger. And now it's up to you, Joe Biden, to figure out how to remove it. I just don't know if this tiger right now, China, is willing to play that game anymore. Nancy Pelosi, by landing in Taipei, I think sent the clearest signal possible to China that the United States is divorcing itself from the one China policy and moving in a direction where ultimately we will recognize the independence of Taiwan. Once we recognize the independence of Taiwan, things can happen, such as treaties, security alliances, and other things that complicate or would complicate China's ability to assert its sovereignty over Taiwan. So I think China's confronted with the fact that the game has changed. Now China has to figure out how it's going to respond. I still believe that China does not want to invade Taiwan, that ultimately China is seeking the peaceful reunification of Taiwan with mainland China. But I think they're going to have to change their tactics. They were hoping that over the long term, they could lure Taiwan in with the promise of economic prosperity, autonomy, et cetera. I think the timeline has changed. Time is no longer on China's side, and China's going to have to change its tactics to ensure that Taiwan never takes the step of declaring independence.
Well, Mr. Sun, do you agree with that assessment? And as we speak, when I ask that question, you have the People's Liberation Army Eastern Theater Command conducting joint military operations near Taiwan. And in a sense, it is said that it has encircled Taiwan with these military operations.
Well, China has a rather specific set of definition for reunification. Namely, Taiwan would have to come under the one country, two system as proposed by China, and perhaps a variation of what China is applying or implementing nowadays in Hong Kong and in Macau, well, a number of residents on the island of Taiwan apparently have doubts about that. So it is up to China to see what sort of means. Would it be peaceful or would it be other than peaceful in order to reunify with Taiwan? Nowadays, I think, of course, with the U.S. and China confronting each other, I think there are forces on Taiwan Island trying to sort of eke out some room. Some would go for perhaps outright independence. Some others would go for de facto independence.
What ratio is that, do you think? What ratio? What balance in terms of who wants independence and who doesn't?
I think both those who go for outright independence and those who go for de facto independence, I think they are occupying the majority of population on the island of Taiwan. But of course, China would view both this sort of independence, either de facto or outright independence, as unacceptable.
Okay. Scott Ritter, these exercises, I need to get your reading on this, because you have, on the one hand, the drills that I talked about, and they include, from what I'm reading here, joint air and sea drills in the north, southeast, and southwest and southeast of Taiwan, including long-range live firing. And then you have the important one that they have said, and here's the confusion, that China announced targeted military operations or exercises. Now, the Defense Ministry of China did not provide details as to whether those are all in one or they're separate. Because when you have the word targeted military operations or exercises, it sounds more provocative in nature. The way that the Defense Ministry has said that if they were separate from the exercises announced by the Eastern Theater Command, they would have come out and say that. There's an ambiguity here. What do you think, and why is it called targeted military operations, do you think?
Well, when one takes a look at what China is doing, you first of all, the scope and scale of these exercises is unprecedented. They literally surrounded Taiwan with major military exercises, live fire military exercises. But they've held military exercises before. A targeted military operation doesn't necessarily mean an act of war, but what we're seeing is that some of these exercises are infringing directly into what Taiwan would consider its territorial waters. And this is a challenge to Taiwan. This is China asserting its authority, its sovereignty over Taiwan, saying, you don't have territorial waters. You belong to me. We're going to exercise where we want. Now, they're not infringing deeply, but they will be within the 14-mile limit. I also believe that some of these exercises will involve the firing of ballistic missiles that will travel over Taiwan. Again, a clear signal that China says, your sovereignty is not at play here. You belong to us. We will do what we want when we want. It's a sign to Taipei that they're literally one step away from being invaded, and that Taipei better toe the line when it comes to reining in any independence movement in Taiwan, whether de facto or, you know, people who want outright independence. This is unacceptable to China. And while China, I believe, continues to try to pursue a peaceful resolution and nonviolent resolution, they're prepared to go to war over this issue. And I think that's the signal China is sending right now. We will go to war if you push us. So don't push us.
Well, Mr. Sun, one of the things that's happening in the near future, in the very near future, is the Chinese President Xi Jinping, who is seeking a third term. So at the party conference, he's got to show strength. And, of course, this comes at this sensitive time. The reaction so far are the military exercises and, of course, the harshest warning that you can give. Maybe Scott Ritter's was a little bit harsher. I'm not sure if you put both of them into context. But if you play with fire, you're going to get burnt, basically, is what the Chinese president told Joe Biden. Do you think that Xi Jinping is going to go just as far as these military exercises are going to go, or is there going to be a harsher response to come down the line?
Well, in a sense, the China side would have to demonstrate a forceful response to Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, because, as you said, this comes at a very sensitive time. You cannot be showing any sign of weakness. But on the other hand, of course, again, this is a very sensitive time. You would not like to escalate the situation into, for example, a full-scale war, let's say, between the China side and the Taiwan side, or between the China side and the U.S. side, because war sometimes would have unintended consequences or results, and sometimes those results may or may not be favorable to you. So I would think this would be from the military perspective.
Well, do you think the U.S. wants a war with China?
I don't think the U.S. would like to have a war with China, because both China and U.S. are nuclear powers. If you look at what's happening in Ukraine, I think that would give you some indication as to U.S. Hesitance to directly engage another nuclear power.
Scott Ritter, does the Ukraine conflict serve as an example, not just for the U.S. to learn some lessons from, but also for China to see how the U.S. has not succeeded? Because if we're looking at the proxy aspect of it, even though many say there are special U.S. operatives on the ground, the U.S. is not achieving the results that it wants in Ukraine. Can that parallel the situation we're seeing now? Were there to be a military confrontation between the U.S. and China?
Well, I think Ukraine provides a number of lessons for China. One is the, as the gentleman indicated, the unpredictability of war. There is no guaranteed outcome. This conflict, although Russia is prevailing, is entering its sixth month. And I don't think there's anybody in China that wants to see a conflict with Taiwan that lasts 6 months. The economic disruption alone will be devastating. Yes, the United States has shown a unwillingness to escalate to force-on-force conflict with Russia, but the United States has poured in tens of billions of dollars of military resources that have made Russia's special military operation very expensive to Russia in terms of lives and materiel. So again, China doesn't want to jump into the fire if there's other ways to achieve what they want. But I don't think China's going to shy away from a fight. I think the key lesson to Ukraine is that if you're going to act militarily, act decisively with overwhelming force and get the job done quickly. Because otherwise, I think, you know, China will find out that bringing Taiwan into the fold might be more, might cost more than they want it to. It might be more expensive than it's worth.
Well, Mr. Sun, let me ask you. Scott Ritter said that China may go as far, maybe, as far as shooting some missiles that'll pass over Taiwan. Of course, there's going to have to be a reaction from the U.S. on this. So explain to us this one China policy that the U.S. has or does not have anymore. Because Biden has said at one point, of which the White House has retracted, that you know, if Taiwan is in any shape or form comes under any type of military attack, that it's going to come out and defend Chinese Taipei militarily.
Well, I think there's this Taiwan Relations Act enacted by the U.S. Congress a number of years ago, whereby the U.S. is to provide some articles of war in a sense, namely materials, namely weapons and various other materials for Taiwan to defend itself. But of course, from time to time, you have U.S. leaders or U.S. presidents promising to defend Taiwan and so on, as Biden did a few months ago. Whether the U.S. is really willing to send troops and perhaps carriers or jet fighters to defend Taiwan in case, for example, of missiles overflying over Taiwan, I think that remains to be seen.
I'm not going to mention the U.S. politician's name, Scott Ritter, because it will ruin the message that he has given out. Okay? I might say that at the end of the program, but he has said to abandon Taiwan would be to abandon democracy and freedom. So he comes out and says, my promise to you and the Taiwanese people, we're going to start making China pay a greater price for what they are doing all over the world. What do you think he means by that?
I think it means that that the United States wants to engage in a new Cold War with China. It's also, talk is cheap. You know, politicians can say whatever they want to say. But the fact of the matter is, China is so far outclassing the United States in terms of its global footprint. The Belt and Roads Initiative has run circles around anything the United States or its allies have done in terms of third world development. The only thing the United States has going for it is military power, and even here it's greatly diminished, as we see in Europe, as we see in the Middle East, and as we see in the Pacific. The United States is in no position to provide active military defense of Taiwan. We don't have any troops earmarked for this. We don't have troops stationed in Taiwan. We don't have equipment prepositioned in Taiwan. And Taiwan is far away from any air bases, meaning that U.S. fighters would have to refuel multiple times in order to have a couple minutes worth of air combat capability against Chinese forces that are operating much closer with larger numbers. It's all rhetoric, it's all talk, it's meaningless, but it does send a signal to China that the game has changed. Maybe it's time that China steps up to the plate and gets ready to, I'm using an American analogy here, but hit a couple home runs.
Sure. Well, one of the things, Mr. Sun, that's not talked about much often here is the one of the manufacturing aspects that Taiwan has somewhat of, I'm not going to say a monopoly, but an expertise on, and that is the manufacturing of computer chips, of which percentages vary, but some say it's as much as 90% of it is provided by Taiwan. How much of that could be an incentive for the U.S. To move in on Chinese Taipei? And, of course, then maybe in some sense, try to prevent China from advancing, because you need those chips to run all these different products that China is involved in.
Well, Taiwan's unique position in the global supply chain for this, as you mentioned, computer chips in recent months, I think, have become, of course, a reason which have been touted for possible U.S. intervention in case Taiwan is under attack. Nowadays, I think, as we see this, what many would call a decoupling of, for example, the economic progress between U.S. and China, when the U.S. is trying to make sure that its supply chain of critical materials is exclusive to itself and its allies, I think there would be more and more calls for Taiwan to be included in this sort of U.S. exclusive global supply chain, especially with materials as important as these computer chips.
Scott Ritter, final question to you. There were many in Chinese Taipei when Nancy Pelosi touched ground that were not for her presence there. There were some demos to that effect. I'm wondering what the type of outcome, if any, this brings the U.S., and whether it was in the back of their minds, Pelosi's mind, for the upcoming midterms in terms of the party maybe advancing, and for us, Pelosi, to make some kind of, to use your word, a home run, because we know they're not doing that well, their party, for the midterms. Is that one of the perhaps motivations?
Well, first of all, we know that Nancy Pelosi acted unilaterally here. She didn't coordinate this with the White House. It wasn't something the Pentagon approved of, and it certainly wasn't something that the State Department approved of. This was purely Nancy Pelosi's own mission, which means it's more about narcissism and ego than about furthering American national security policy. Nancy Pelosi, you know, might be scoring some points in Washington, D.C. at the moment. I'm sure she's very popular in Taipei, but, you know, the longer this drags on, the more reality is going to hit home. The American people really aren't that caught up in the issue of Taiwan right now. They're more worried about the economy at home. And this is what's going to resonate in November, and there's nothing Nancy Pelosi's doing on this trip that's going to assist to reverse that. And in Taipei, I think they're going to wake up in the coming days to realize that it was a big mistake to welcome Nancy Pelosi. that they're going to pay a very, very heavy price, economically, maybe even militarily.
We're going to end it there. Scott Ritter, thank you, former UN weapons inspector. That was Lindsey Graham who said that quote that I didn't mention when I asked you that question. Oh, a son, principal advisor at Pacific Research Center of Malaysia. Thank you so much. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitale and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We're looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali.